Author Ta-Nehisi Coates has a lot to say about race, President Trump, and the Civil War. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Author Ta-Nehisi Coates was recently in Miami talking about his book, We Were 8 Years in Power. He shared his thoughts on slavery, the Obama presidency, and the reasons racism still exists in the most unlikely of places. Also on the program, Dr. Marvin Dunn wrote a definitive book about African Americans in Miami. He was recently running for Congress, but he dropped out. For Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we look back on the history of racism and civil rights in South Florida. All of that coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, it's Martin Luther King Day, and we're starting our show by talking to one of the country's most renowned scholars of African American history, who happens to live right here in South Florida. It's Dr. Marvin Dunn, Professor Emeritus at Florida International University, where he was head of the Department of Psychology. He's the author of the book Black Miami in the 20th Century, and we're talking to him from Atlanta. Dr. Dunn, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, you know, the most famous aspects of the civil rights movement are the sit-ins and protests of the 1950s and 60s. But you say that here in Florida, it started even earlier than that. When did the civil rights movement start here?
Actually, in May of 1945. That really was the first civil rights demonstration that I'm aware of in the South. And that was conducted by Father Theodore Gibson and some black ministers when they did a wade-in at a county beach, Baker's Holover Beach, in order to force the county to open a beach for blacks, which the county eventually did, and opened Virginia Key Beach in 1945. Now, that was 15 years before the demonstrations in Greensboro that occurred in the sit-in, the civil rights movement. That was activity in Miami, particularly over access to the water. Just in terms of a little bit of background on what had happened with Virginia Key, the Navy had been allowed to use Virginia Key Beach to train Negro sailors to swim, since the county, Dade County, would not allow the Navy to bring black soldiers over to Clanton Park to be trained. So they allowed Virginia Key to be used, and when the war was over, the military left and the beach was closed. And Father Gibson, who headed up the Christ Episcopal Church in Coconut Grove, and other ministers, asked the county to leave the beach open for blacks. They were not asking to integrate Clanton Park. They were simply asking for a beach for Negroes, and the county said no. So in May of 45, Father Gibson led a group to a county beach, Baker's Holover Beach, and they did a wade-in. And within a month, the county opened Virginia Key Beach, and that's... Yeah, that's where I swam when I was a boy, growing up in Miami in the 1950s. But that's how we got that beach.
All right. You know what, Dr. Dunn, I want to stop for just a moment. I apologize because the connection that we have with you is starting to get a little bit scratchy. If you happen to be on a cordless phone, if you could get as close as possible to the base, we'll see.
Let me see if I can do that. Just hold on a second.
Sure.
I'm going to go back into another area, which might be a little bit better. Just hold on.
Not a problem at all. I love live radio, so that's okay.
All right. Yes, I think it is.
All right. Let's go. We'll continue from there. You grew up here, first in Central Florida, then in Miami. Give us an idea of what segregation meant in Florida when you were a child.
Well, I was born in 1940, and Jim Crow was in full force. I rode in the back of the bus, as was required at the time. I went to a segregated school, both in Volusia County and in Miami-Dade County. I was one of the students that they would send over to the white school to get their used textbooks and Bunsen burners to bring back to the black school. So it was a very, very segregated system as I was coming up, and even into 1957 when I went to college, riding on the back of a Greyhound bus, as it turned out. So I did experience all of those things. When I went to work with my mother, we went in through the back door. My mother cleaned houses for people. My dad was a fruit picker. So we were, you know, just working class people trying to struggle and make it. Eventually, my dad was able to move the family to Miami, to Opa-locka, where he eventually got a job as a longshoreman, which meant that there was a pension and there were certain securities we didn't have previously. We'd been a migrant family working on the migrant stream. So that's essentially how we managed to get our feet established in Miami.
And I'm wondering, were the communities you grew up in completely segregated?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Miami was terrible. There were places you couldn't go if you were black in Miami in the 1950s. Housing was very, very segregated. When the Dade County school system finally was forced to desegregate public schools, they desegregated Orchard Villa Elementary School, which was all white when they desegregated. It's in Liberty City. By Christmas vacation, all the white kids were gone, except maybe one or two white kids were left. They went to private schools. Their parents took them out of school rather than having them attend the first desegregated public school in Dade County. So that was resistance. Blacks could not use the golf courses. These were public golf courses. City of Miami Golf Course was not open to blacks. I take that back. After some black veterans demonstrated against the golf course being closed to blacks, the city allowed blacks to use the golf course one day a week, which I think was on Mondays when the greens were being watered. That was the only access blacks had to the golf courses. So I witnessed all of that, grew up with all of that.
I want to ask you about the fight over Virginia Key. You briefly mentioned it again here in Miami. Previously, yes. What kind of beach facilities were available to African Americans?
In Dade County?
Yeah.
None. None. Well, actually, if you go way back to the 1930s, Mr. D.A. Dorsey, Miami's first black millionaire, owned a good part of what's now Fisher Island. This was in the late 20s, early 30s. He purchased that property because blacks were not allowed to go into salt water once the railroad came in 1896. So Mr. Dorsey bought that beach, and local blacks as well as blacks coming in from out of town could take a ferry or a boat that they had that would take them out to what's now Fisher Island. And then Carl Fisher purchased that part of the island from Mr. Dorsey and developed Miami Beach. But at one point, yes, that was the only way that blacks could get into salt water. Interestingly, I was told that before the railroad came in, that blacks did have access to salt water. It was the arrival of the railroad and expected white tourists that led to blacks not being able to go into the sea.
And then Virginia Key became the beach African Americans could use, but you needed a boat to get there.
That's correct. There was a boat that left, that's right, on the hour, on the weekends, just on the weekends. As a matter of fact, when I was a boy using that beach, on Saturdays and Sundays, the state would have two state troopers parked on the bridge leading over to Clarendon Park to make sure that blacks didn't cross that bridge going over to the white beach. But we thought that was great. We didn't realize that was a sewage outfall right around the corner from the beach, but we had salt water.
And this was in Miami. In the following years, African Americans in other Florida communities began holding, weigh-ins because they saw what was happening in Virginia Key. Did the victory there get people thinking maybe there are more things we can change?
Well, there were other things happening as well. There were other so-called colored beaches in Florida. Fort Lauderdale had one. Jacksonville had one. So there were these places that had been accepted as to where the colored people go. What really, really made the difference was when these veterans from World War II came back home and demanded that things be different. So you had very, very strong activism in the mid-1940s to early 1950s at the behest mainly of veterans who insisted on change.
It was in the 80s that Virginia Key Beach was closed to the public for years. Do you think the county should have tried harder to preserve the history?
Well, they have done some preservation out there. I think more could and should be done. And I give credit to Gene Tenney and others who have worked hard to reserve and preserve that history. But that's very valuable land, and there are pressures on it to be used for other purposes. So I think the fight to protect that legacy needs to continue.
What's it like for you as a historian, just walking around and driving around town? You know, are you constantly thinking about the history, some of which you lived through yourself?
Yes. There are very few places that I go to where some aspect of Miami history, and particularly Black history, doesn't strike me. Coconut Grove, certainly that deep, deep Bahamian culture there. North Dade, Bunch Park, the area that was segregated for Black veterans, which is why my dad was allowed to buy a property, my dad and mom, in this particular development. Yes, I feel history every place that I go, including some of the places where some very bad things happened, like the riot in Liberty City in 1980.
Right.
I'm often up in that area as well.
You know, I'm wondering, a person like you who's been through so much and you've seen so much of that change here in South Florida, what's your take on where Miami, where South Florida, where we are as a nation right now, considering, again, it is Martin Luther King Day? What are your thoughts on how far we've come, how far we have left to go?
Well, you know, I am not dissuaded by the recent political events in this country. I don't like the direction the country is moving. I do not particularly care for this president. I do not care for the tone in civil discourse in this country right now. But as President Obama and maybe others have said, our country is strong enough to survive difficult moments. And this is a difficult moment when you have someone in national leadership who is playing to racial division. It's very difficult to maintain a sense of this is just a phase that the country is going through. Remember, most people in this country, even in the worst days of the Klan, did not join the KKK. Most people, whites now, do not join these extremist pro-Nazi groups. The problem is a lot of people sit back and don't speak up when they see these things happening. And that's part of our legacy going back to the beginning of United States history, up to the present. Speaking out when you see something wrong. I don't think that this current atmosphere represents what our country really is. I think the fact that most people really rejected this particular direction of the country speaks for itself.
Historian Marvin Dunn, his most recent book is The Beast in Florida, A History of Anti-Black Violence. Dr. Dunn, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right, coming up next on Sundial, we're going to hear from a previous conversation between WLRN's Nadej Green and author Ta-Nehisi Coates. More on that coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Last week, reports came out that President Trump had used a racially disparaging vulgarity about groups from specific countries, though he has since issued denials. That same evening, author Ta-Nehisi Coates spoke at a community conversation sponsored by the Miami Book Fair held at the Wolfson campus of Miami-Dade College. We're going to hear excerpts of that talk now, and we should let you know that Coates repeats that language used by the president. Allegedly, he also uses a racial slur that many people will find offensive. WLRN's Nadej Green moderated the discussion. She started by asking Ta-Nehisi Coates how he thinks the Civil War helps us understand racial dynamics today.
800,000 people, I think, died in the Civil War. More people died in the Civil War than all American wars combined. Maybe until recently, maybe that just got eclipsed recently. I feel like I read something about it finally, you know, being. But for a long time, it was like more death. So more Americans died in the Civil War like than in World War II, you know, plus World War I, plus Vietnam, you know, plus the Revolutionary War, plus the, that's a lot of death over the course of, you know, five, you know, relatively brief years. There were whole, you know, battles at which more people died than in certain wars. Antietam, Gettysburg. That's a lot of death. That's a lot of death. And so if you did, as I did when I was first exploring this, so when you went to the battlefields, you know, and you heard how people talked about that death, and you heard the reasons that they gave, for instance, you know, states' rights, or, you know, they were down here, you know, so, you know, we fought them and we didn't want them down here. It didn't add up to 800,000 people dying. This didn't quite, I mean, like states' right, what right? What specific right? You know, people get kind of fuzzy on that, right? It was always like a mystery for me, like how could that many people have died, you know, for something? And once you begin to grapple with what the right actually was, you know, you begin to get it. Once you, you know, grapple with the fact that, you know, there were 4 million enslaved African Americans in this country at the time of the Civil War, that those enslaved Africans, you know, put together were worth, you know, some $3 billion, something like $75 billion in today's currency. That $3 billion at the time was the largest source of wealth in America. That it was worth more than all other assets in this country, all our railroads, all our banks, all our nascent factories, all our shipyards, all of it put together, the bodies of those 4 million enslaved Africans were worth more. When you understand that the, you know, greatest concentration of millionaires in 1860 was in the Mississippi River Valley, when you understand that the majority of the people living in South Carolina were enslaved, represented a piece of that wealth, that the half the people living in Georgia, living in Louisiana, were parts of that wealth, African Americans. When you, you know, begin to look at, you know, where black people were and where they were enslaved and who seceded when, it begins to make sense, because what you can see is you have a large class of wealth right there. And you can then begin to understand how people might go to war on that wealth. When I, you know, go out to talk, you know, about the Civil War, sometimes I get people, they say, well, my great-great-grandfather, you know, he didn't own any slaves, but he fought, you know, for the, you know, the Confederacy. So it can't be about slavery. I said, well, your great-great-grandfather might not have owned slaves, but I'll show you he wanted to own slaves. and he wanted to own slaves. Listen, he didn't want to own slaves because he's a, you know, a uniquely bad person. You know, had I been him at that point in time and I had been white and living in the society he lived in, I would have wanted to own slaves too. Do you know why? Because slaves was how you accumulated wealth. That was accepted. The system was set up in that way. It's not just the wealth. Just like, you know, homes today, I always say, like, it's a crude thing, you know, to say, but that's the closest corollary between slaveholding in 1860, it's home ownership today. And I say that to say, we use home ownership to build our wealth, but home ownership is also a social institution. It's a thing that, you know, you talk about. I don't own a home, right? But I know how homeowners talk. And I know how homeowners talk about putting an extension on the house and, you know what I mean? When the kid moves out, what they're gonna do to this room, and their homeowner associations that talk about who's doing what on the block, and people get upset about. It's a thing in America. It's an idea to own a home. It signals your arrival. And so that's what slaveholding was in the South. You just couldn't really be a rich person in South Carolina and not own slaves. It just didn't happen. Much like you wouldn't be a rich person in America today and not own a home. What would it mean if today we were to abolish home ownership? If we were to say, you know what, we're going to liquidate all the holdings that you have in your home. We're just going to liquidate. We're going to nationalize it, you know, and we're going to release all of that wealth that's held in there. Well, people who own homes would probably, you know, fight about it. But not only that, people who one day hope to own homes would probably fight about it. It's worth extending that question out even further. What would that mean for the society? How long would it take us to get over the fact that generations of people had once, you know, built up this idea of home ownership and no longer had that anymore? Slavery in this country, including the colonial times, started in 1619, went to 1860. You're talking about roughly 350 years. The period of freedom, relative freedom. I want to be really clear about that, because there's an argument that unfreedom continues certainly in the South for another 100 years. But even being conservative, period of freedom is only 150 years. So when you look not just at the people that died in the Civil War, when you look at the terrorism that immediately followed, when you look at the failure of Reconstruction, when you look at Jim Crow, when you look at the rise of the Klan first in the 1860s and then in the 1920s and then again in the 1960s, when you look at how the New Deal, you know, was fashioned to exclude black people, when you look at all the racist episodes, I would argue all the way up through mass incarceration, you are seeing the aftershocks of the Civil War. They've never quite figured out how to deal with the descendants of those 4 million African Americans as free, equal people in this country. And so it's not a mistake, you know, when Michelle Alexander, you know, talks about, for instance, you know, incarceration as the new Jim Crow. Some people feel like that's overinflated rhetoric, or it's overheated, or, you know, metaphor doesn't, you know, and they get caught up in these particulars. But as an overarching idea, that black people are most familiar to me in some sort of unfree status, it's an old idea. It's an old idea, and it directly goes back to some things that we did not resolve, you know, during the Civil War. So I maintain that you really can't understand American history. Not black people. You can't understand American history if you can't understand why those 800,000 people died, if you can't get that.
So we had a black president.
We did.
And many pointed to President Barack Obama's election as a turning point in this country. Mm-hmm. We read think pieces, and it's all good now. Mm-hmm. We're post-racial, mm-hmm. America has atoned for its sins, a black man is leading the country. Mm-hmm. Were you hopeful in that way?
I didn't think he would win, and then when he won, I thought that it was possible that I was living in a different country than I thought I was. And I was. I was. In certain ways, I was. I did. I don't want to, like, it's, you can get trapped, man, between, like, cynicism and this kind of, you know, overinflated optimism, this kind of naivete, you know? And so there's one way where you can go and you can say, well, that election didn't mean anything. You know, and then there's another way you go where you say, well, you know, this clearly, you know, means that America's pure and it's good. And you know what I mean? And I think you have to start by saying Barack Obama, a black man, could probably not be president 20 years ago. It probably wasn't possible. It certainly wasn't possible 30 years ago. It 100% was not possible 40, 50 years ago. So you have to say that is some sort of progress. It's a kind of progress. It means if you are an individual of particular intelligence who works really, really hard, who gets really, really lucky, you might be president. That's a thing that could possibly happen to you. 50 years ago, it just didn't matter. It just wasn't going to happen, period. The problem is white people don't either need to work hard or be particularly lucky to be president, or be particularly intelligent. I mean, no disrespect, but the two men that sandwiched Barack Obama are not noted for their intellect. That's not what people say about that. I don't, you know what I mean? I'm just telling you, you know what I mean? I'm just saying. That's not what, you know, try to imagine. I can't even get it out. Try to imagine a black male version of Donald Trump. That dude is in prison right now. I mean, you can't get off the block like that, man. Much less get to the White House. You couldn't get to city council, brother. Obviously. You know, I mean, it's incredible. And so I think what Barack Obama ultimately meant was that the best, and by best I mean, you know, most acceptable, most credentialed, the people who could best speak to America on America's terms can go far in America. But white people don't have to do anything to go far. They don't have to do anything, you know, in comparison to go far. That's not equality. Equality is when, God, and I shudder at saying this, but it's when you have a black person who can be as naive, as stupid, as ignorant, you know, as unthinking, as incurious, as lazy as Donald Trump, and be president. That's equality then. That is the day when we will have equality. It's not equality to say Barack Obama got to go out and be, you know, head of the Harvard Law Review and do, you know what I mean, and be, you know, exceptional and all that. That's not equality, man.
In nicer terms, you had said, the right to be mediocre.
The right to be mediocre. It's precious. It's sacred. Black people do not have a right to be mediocre. You end up in jail, you know?
You're listening to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and this is a previous conversation between WLRN's Nadej Green and author Ta-Nehisi Coates during a community conversation sponsored by the Miami Book Fair. It was held at the Miami-Dade College Wolfson campus last week. Now, this conversation happened the same day there were reports that President Trump used racially disparaging vulgarities towards some groups from specific countries, though he has since issued denials. We should let you know again that Ta-Nehisi Coates repeats that language during this conversation, and he uses a racial slur that many people will find offensive.
In your essay, Fear of a Black President, you opened with President Barack Obama's response to the Trayvon Martin shooting. That especially resonated here in South Florida because Trayvon and his family are from here, Miami
right.
Gardens.
Right.
When President Obama said if he had a son, he would look like Trayvon Martin, he was talking to all parents and all of the country, right? But that was a very black moment
right.
in his presidency that addressed racial dynamics head on. And he swiftly came under attack for it.
Right.
You describe that moment as an irony. Why?
Effectively, they had elected a black president that they did not want to be black.
Right. Didn't want to talk about race.
No, they wanted, you know, like the skin color, the tone. But they didn't want him to say anything that was informed by the experience of being black in the country. It was the irony of him. That moment really exposed it. Because, I mean, I have my disagreements with President Obama, and had him over the course of, time when he was president. But I think, that was sincere. That was real. Like, he wasn't, there was no points to be gained from doing it. Wasn't no swing votes he was getting by saying that. You know what I mean? Like, he was really speaking from his own, and I know having interviewed people, he wanted to make that statement, him. Like, he wanted to say that, And so you would think, because it was actually a relatively mild statement, you would think that people would not flip out over that. But they did. And you realize that, the country had elected, it liked the idea of a black man in the White House, in theory. But the reality of that man bringing forth his experiences and speaking in a way informed by the black experience, that would be a problem. That would be a problem.
And so we went from having the first black president to what you coined the first white president.
Right.
What does that mean?
It goes back to Between the World and Me. And Between the World and Me is built on a lot of the scholarship that's been done in the history departments around this country. And I think one of the great insights that has come out of that, put it in Between the World and Me, is race is the child of racism, not the father. And the idea is that we have a notion in our country that I look a certain way, you look different than me. And so, therefore, you decide you want to take my land or enslave me and make me work in a cotton field. But that's the basic dynamic. It's because we look different than each other that makes us want to oppress or do mean things to each other. In fact, when you look at the history, that's actually not true. It's always the robbery that happens first. And then people look for reasons to justify the robbery. We are both black on this stage. I'm happy to be black. I'm happy to be in the same, ethnic group with you.
Ditto.
But, it really doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't, it's a fact of history that it's that way. It's not, anything, if we, for instance, if the two of us existed in Brazil, might not be the same race. If the two of us existed in Louisiana in the 1700s, might not be the same race. The two of us existed under apartheid in South Africa, might not be the same race. There's nothing particularly real about race as a category. Now, there's a lot of real things about African-American culture and ethnicity. But there's no, idea that, we look a certain way, and so therefore, we're naturally supposed to be at each other's throats or naturally supposed to be, allies. It's a fact of a done thing. And so, if black as a category is a done thing, I maintain that white as a category is a done thing, and you have the right to define it. And one of the key things about the idea of whiteness in this country is that it is always dependent on some outgroup. And mostly it's dependent on black people. It's an idea of what we are not. It's a negative identity. You know, we're not savage. You know, we work hard. You know, we have middle class values. We're smart. We're intelligent. And you see this repeating itself and, you know, sort of transfiguring all through history. One of my favorites is like when Jack Johnson wins the world heavyweight. Before Jack Johnson wins the world heavyweight, the idea is that black people don't possess, and it's a very gendered, you know, notion here, but that black people and black men in particular don't possess the manliness, you know, the sophistication actually, to be heavyweight and the courage to be heavyweight champion of the world. And as soon as Jack Johnson gets in there and kicks ass, he won because he was a savage. You understand? It was a total flip. You know, there are articles, for instance, during the 1940s and the 1930s, when Jews dominated the college circuit for basketball in New York. And if you go back and read those articles, you see all sorts of racial justifications. Like, Jews are tricky, that's why they dominate basketball. You know, artful dodging, and, you know, it's a game of, you know, cagey. You know, the cagey Jew excels at basketball. I mean, really, this is what people were writing at the time, right? But then it's black people, and it's like, oh, it's because they, you know, can leap like gorillas and apes. That's why they're dominant. It shifts over and over and over again, as is needed. And it defines itself against somebody else. What is Donald Trump without Barack Obama? What is the Trump presidency without Barack Obama? I mean, everything is defined against Barack Obama. Everything. Everything, his entire idea for being. Would Trump exist without birtherism? I mean, literally, that's how he started his campaign. So we know as a fact in terms of how he exists right now, it could not have happened without birtherism. People think like the bigotry and the white supremacy is a side course. It's not. It's the central thing. If you took it away, you could not possibly have Trump. So that's to speak of him. You know, he's the first president to define himself against a black president. And we certainly have had presidents before that that did racist things. We certainly have presidents that checked white on the census, but none had the luxury of defining themselves against a nigger president before. Because there were none. There were no black presidents before. There was no negative. There was nobody in that category to define yourself against. And then when you start looking at, you know, his actual coalition, you know, one of the points I made in that essay is a lot of people, they spend a lot of time talking about economic, you know, insecurity and economic anxiety and this, that, and the third. And nobody knows more about economic insecurity and economic anxiety than the black and brown people in this country. We did not respond by going out and voting for a misogynistic bigot for president. That was not our response to our economic anxiety. That's only certain people's response to economic anxiety. But the problem is, poor white people voted for Donald Trump in a majority. Working class white people voted for Donald Trump in a majority. Middle class and upper middle class white people voted for Donald Trump in a majority. Rich white people voted for Donald Trump in a majority. White men voted for Donald Trump in a majority. White women voted for Donald Trump in a majority. White people who went to college, didn't go to college, dropped out of high school, all across the board, all voted for Donald Trump. So what is the most salient thread that goes through? What do all these people have in common? You know, I mean, maybe it's economic anxiety, but why? Why are they economically anxious? Why did it have anything to do with there being a black president before? Is it just a coincidence? You know, you see this going on. You know, today I was just reading the New York Times article about how, you know, what do you see called the countries in Africa and Haiti, shithole countries, right? The president of the United States said this today. The word racism does not appear in that article. Why did he say that? Is it just a coincidence that it's black people in Haiti and black people in Africa that he happened to mention that, and that his ideal was Norway? Was that just a mistake? No, but y'all are laughing, but people think that. People, I mean, this just goes back to what I was talking about, the lie.
Again, you're listening to a pre-recorded conversation between WLRN's Nadege Green and author Ta-Nehisi Coates. It was held at the Miami-Dade College Wolfson campus last week, sponsored by the Miami Book Fair. We'll have more on this conversation coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, let's return to our previous conversation between WLRN's Nadej Green and author Ta-Nehisi Coates. It was during a community conversation sponsored by the Miami Book Fair held at the Miami-Dade College Wolfson campus last week. Now, this conversation happened the same day there were the reports that President Trump used racially disparaging vulgarities towards certain groups from specific countries, though he has since issued denials. We should let you know that Ta-Nehisi Coates repeats that language during this conversation, and he uses a racial slur that many people will find offensive. Let's return to the conversation.
And also interesting, he was here in Miami campaigning. When he was campaigning in Miami, I covered his campaign, and he spoke specifically to the Haitian community here. He had a meeting in Little Haiti.
How'd that go?
In which he said, it was interesting. Uh-huh. But there were Haitian Trump support. Well, there were all Haitian Trump supporters in the room. The community says they were handpicked. Because there were non-Trump supporters outside who were like, no one called us to tell
Have
us to come to this meeting.
Have you gone back to interview the Haitians who supported Trump?
Yes.
And what do they say now?
They still support him.
Wow, Jesus Christ.
There are Haitians who still support Donald Trump. But it was what I found
well,
in the community. It was less about being for Donald Trump than it was about being against Hillary Clinton because of her legacy in Haiti and perceptions of the Clinton Foundation in Haiti. So it was messy.
You know what, though? The thing is,
But he did tell them at that meeting,
right,
I will be your champion. And since then, I think there are two stories that came out, both New York Times, one both quoting anonymous sources in a room saying, you know, he talked about Haitians having HIV/AIDS,
right,
which is a huge stigma that Haitians had to deal with, have fought against, and now this, so.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, like, the thing about, just really quickly, bragging, I you know what I mean? I have my share of criticism of Hillary Clinton and the Clintons. Who you vote for matters. And sometimes you may not love who you have to vote for. I did not. I definitely did not. But Jeff Sessions is not Eric Holder. Whatever you think of Hillary Clinton, and I do not doubt that they did horrible things with the foundation. I want to be real clear about this is not a defense of Hillary Clinton. But when you see that dude in the Oval Office calling your country a shithole, I mean, that's just, like, Bush wouldn't have even done that. You know what I mean? Like, that's remarkable. I mean, it's another level. And I don't know. Trump has a long career of deep-seated contempt for black people.
Your book, after the title, Dedication, there's a Jay-Z quote. Mm-hmm. We don't just shine, we illuminate the whole show.
Yeah.
Hip-hop influences you a lot. What role does hip-hop play in how you write?
Oh, I learned how to write from rappers first. I know how to write from and comic books. The thing people have to understand about rappers when they're trying to be really lyrical, and everybody ain't trying to do that, that's okay. That's okay. I'm good. And it's not even an age thing. There were people, you know, when I was young who really weren't trying to be good. Everybody wasn't great. If you're trying to be good, you have a limited space in which to say something. And you're trying to say it with as much emotional impact as possible. And so that makes you have to be very choosy about your words. And any great rapper, you know, you listen to Jay-Z at his height, listen to Nas at his height, listen to Wu at their height. What they are is tremendously efficient. In a, you know, relatively, you know, small space, they can make you feel something. You know, every time I heard that, you know, line, we don't just shine, we illuminate the whole show, it just made me, like, feel a certain way. And it wasn't just about Jay-Z. You know what I mean? It was, you know, a deeply, deeply reflective. For instance, in that book, you know, like, for me, it's about black people in this country. You know, that black people actually, that, you know, through studying black people in this country, you can illuminate the whole show. You can understand America. That, in fact, this is, I would argue, one of the best ways to understand America, you know, from this perspective. It will illuminate so much that you think is not touched, you know, by the idea of blackness. And so it was the first place I learned efficiency. It was the first place I learned how to write in such a way to make people feel something, not just to, you know, structure your arguments logically to be correct, but to actually achieve emotional impact. It was the first literature that had real emotional impact on me. I was, and I, you know, still am, but as a younger person, man, I would like play Rakim, you know, let the rhythm him over and over and over and over again. You know, trying to figure out how this dude did this. And I, you know, I never really did. But the effort of doing it, you know, playing Illmatic over and over and over and over again, playing the roots over and over and over and over again, you know, just listening. I mean, you begin to get some sort of aesthetics and values, you know, in terms of how you want to organize, you know, your own words. And so I, you know, these are my first teachers, you know, in terms of writing.
Again, you're listening to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and this is a pre-recorded conversation between WLRN's Nadej Green and author Ta-Nehisi Coates. It was sponsored by the Miami Book Fair and held at the Miami-Dade College Wolfson campus last week. And again, just a reminder, you will hear some language that some people will find offensive during this conversation.
You used to have a blog, and you talked about interacting with the commenters, right?
Right.
That it was a two-way street. You got something from those comments, whether it was advice, whether it was critique, whether it was a book recommendation. As you evolved, that blog went away, but then there was Twitter. Mm-hmm. You're no longer on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
And just before you went dark on Twitter, you were responding to sharp criticism from Cornel West and others who agreed with him.
Yeah, that was a mistake. That was a huge mistake.
You called it a mistake.
Yeah, it was a big mistake. I didn't come to fight Cornel West. I didn't get in this to fight Cornel West. I am very clear about what I'm engaged in and what I'm engaged with. And I knew that even as I was responding. So my response, to the extent that I gave one, was to say, what I was most concerned about was people who read his evaluation of the book and did not read the book. And I thought it was some very important factual things that needed to be said. So, you know, when Cornell gave, you know, his first interview and said, well, you know, if you ain't talking about white supremacy and you ain't doing it, I said, listen, it's on page 2. Check out the book, you know? You say, well, you know, Ta-Nehisi's silent, you know, on drones. I said, no, I'm not. Here it is, right here. I wrote about it. You know what I mean? Sometimes he's silent on gender. I'm not. I wrote about it. LGBT. It's important. I want people to not forget. You know what I mean? That's part of me, that I did it. Is it, you know, the thing I'm an expert on? No. And so I wanted to do that. I wanted that to have, you know, there to be a record of that. But that was actually a mistake because it misunderstood what was actually happening. I thought that there was some sort of debate going on. There was not a debate going on. There was a show going on. And I didn't catch that. I didn't realize that. And you know when I realized it, and please don't take this the wrong way, because there were all sorts of people doing things like this. When I realized it was, I got a tweet directed at me, and the sister said, here are 5 women who critiqued Ta-Nehisi before Cornel West. I said, oh, y'all trying to eat. That's what this is. That's what this is. This is like, we're not, you know, we're not having a factual exchange here. It doesn't really matter whether I've written on this, because if I had, you'll say you didn't write enough on it. That wasn't loud enough. That wasn't, you know, so there's something else symbolic, you know, going on here that is actually way past me. You know what I mean? So my regret is that in, you know, attempting to respond, I think I threw more fuel on it. And one of the really depressing things was to see, you know, like people I knew, you know, people I actually knew. I mean, this, and I talk about this in the book. I mean, part of my journey that I'm still in is largely before Between the World and Me or before the Case for Reparations, I felt like a relatively normal person. And I have not felt like a normal person since. Mm. And so, and I'm not bragging about that. I'm saying, like, in a bad way, I have not felt like a normal. Like, I haven't felt like Ta-Nehisi since then.
So I know we want to open up to the audience questions. So the first question is, what writers' books influenced you the most? From Christina G. at Bookish Christina handle.
Wow. I mean, obviously, like I said, hip-hop, you know what I mean? That's a huge one. When I was at Howard, I read their eyes were watching God and Jonas Gorvine. This is important because I'm in Florida. And that was the first fiction I ever read that really felt black to me, by which I meant I love that Zora Neale Hurston was not afraid of how black people talked, was not afraid of black culture. In fact, saw that like as a fuel, like that was a thing she was reaching. So all of that other, most of it, not all of it, but most of the other Harlem Renaissance stuff that I couldn't relate to, you know, it was written in this kind of high way, and she was like, you know, in the dirt. So that had a huge influence on me. That taught me to never be afraid of myself. In terms of writing, speaking, whatever. You are who you are, and that's where your power is. I was a huge poetry person in college, so like Amiri Baraka, Sonia Sanchez, Yusef Kumanyaka, Carolyn Forche, all these people were big for me. E.L. Doctorow was absolutely gigantic for me. Doctorow made history come alive. And all of those myths I've been talking about, you know, through tonight, he, you know, was like one of the greatest at writing, you know, this really, in this page-turning, almost genre fiction way, but at the same time directing it towards something to, you know, assault, you know, mythology. Obviously, James Baldwin. James Baldwin was absolutely huge to me. You know, like, when I look at, like, The Fire Next Time and I think about it, that, you know, and I tell this story and We Were 8 Years in Power, but like I was reading it at you know, before I even got to Between the World and Me, and I just was stunned. People don't understand, like Baldwin, because he's so incredible on video, and because he's so incredible when he talks, people actually don't realize how much of a genius writer and journalist he really, really was. It's Baldwin as a figure now, and that's cool. I'm happy that's true, but I just want to remind people, like, you read The Fire Next Time. This dude can write in this beautifully lyrical way. He has this incredible insight into his own history. He has the ability to go out and do reporting as he does with Elijah Muhammad and somehow pull that into the narrative and make it part of it. And then he has the analytical skill to actually understand what, and he's doing, most people can do like one of those things. It's very rare that you find somebody that's doing it, you know, and shifting gears from paragraph to paragraph. To anybody who's ever tried to write, it's extremely hard to do that. You know what I mean? To move in that, you know, it's like watching, you know, a great running back, you know, on the field who can just stop on a dime, shift, may run you over, or may, you know, juke. Like, that's what Baldwin is, you know, when you read him. And so when I went to Between the World and Me, I was like, I ain't doing that. But you know what? You might learn something if you try.
And again, that was a pre-recorded conversation that we had. It was between WLRN's Nadege Green and author Ta-Nehisi Coates. It was during a community conversation that was sponsored by the Miami Book Fair, and it was held at the Miami-Dade College Wolfson campus last week. And by the way, you can learn more about that conversation at our website, WLRN.org. And that is the show for Monday, January 15th. Again, I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. Talk to you tomorrow.